Generous support for Coastal Windage comes from Cameron's Restaurant Pub and Inn, and now RV Park. Cameron's is the only true British pub on the coastside, featuring 19 beers on tap and more than 60 brands of bottles. Come for the food and stay for the fun. Happy hour specials Monday through Friday. Open mic night on Thursday and karaoke on Friday and Saturday. Cameron's Restaurant Pub in Half Moon Bay.
It's summer on the coast, and you know what that means. No, not more fog. It means Ruben is on vacation, and it's time for the Summer Mike Series. Here's your host for the Summer Mike Series, Crystalyn.
Is not full of dinosaurs and running for his life, and that he's relaxing and having a good time. And I'm joined here today with my favorite person to talk all things Coastside with, Michelle Dragony of Coastside Buzz. Good morning.
Well, good morning, Crystalyn, and good morning, Ruben. I know you're listening from afar. How could you not? Well, welcome, everybody. I enjoy coming on to Coastal Windage and checking it out on here, and I want to, we have a new phone number because we're in Frank's studio, which is really cool. It's got an on-air thing that's blinky. There's wall-to-wall CDs and albums. It's very cool. But the phone number to call in case you want to ask Buzz or ask Crystalyn anything is 650-560-9851. 650-560-9851. And so, how are you?
I'm good. How was your week? Anything fun and exciting? I know you started the weekend by going to the Harbor's Salmon.
The Salmon Smolt release. Oh, yes. I really like that. It was actually kind of cool because Peter Dreckmeyer, who's in charge of the Tuolumne Land Trust, he came down and gave a speech, and all of the harbor commissioners showed up with their dogs, which is was sort of a thing with the harbor. They bring their dogs to their meetings. And there was a really good turnout considering we didn't find out when the release was going to be, like, but a week before. Put it out on Buzz, of course, and it was on some social media. But one of the coolest things was a friend of mine brought her. I sent her a link to the event, and I said, you know, Antonio might want to come down and check it out. And he was a little bit sleepy because it was like at 9 o'clock in the morning, and little kids will sleep in, you know, when they don't have to go to school. But he was in awe of seeing all of these little baby salmon being just shot out from this cannon into the pen. And then they put the pen together like, maybe 3 weeks ago. And then for 3 weeks in a row, the hatchery brings three trucks each time. So there's a total of 750,000 smolt that go into the pen. And then they acclimate in the outer harbor for a week. And then the guys drag the pen outside of the harbor, not too far, and let all of the smolt go. Smolt don't always go very far. And 2 or 3 years go by, they're salmon. Big salmon. And so the fishermen, that's one of the ways that some of the fishermen around here are surviving.
That is so interesting. And that they have to plan so far ahead and think so far ahead that we're going to put babies in there now. It's interesting that they did it on, is it coincidental that they did it on the same weekend that there was the fishing was open?
Oh, totally coincidental. And that's when it made it more difficult for everybody in the harbor, because when the salmon season, it's only a 2-day season this year. It might go 2 more days in July. I have not seen how many fish were caught, but they're only allowed to catch 7,500 fish this year.
Like total between all of them?
For all of the fishermen, yep. They only get to catch that many, so it's not very many. And from what I could tell just on social media, everybody was coming back with their two fish. And then there's California Department of Fish and Wildlife. They have people that are at the end of the docks, particularly the ones where the people pay to go out on a party boat and go fishing. And so when everybody comes up the ramp, you know, to go on the pier to go home, the Fish and Wildlife people will have a look at their salmon, and there's a little fin that they chop off. It's the adipose fin, and they chop it off, and that's how the Fish and Wildlife people know that there's a chip in the head. And so when they see the fin missing, they chop the head off, and they put it in a bucket, actually in a cooler. And then there's a little piece of wire that's embedded inside the head, and they take it to their science lab, and then they take the wire out, and then they know which hatchery the fish came from.
Oh.
And so the trick is to see, because these came from the Tuolumne, another rendition that came from the Feather River. So there's different hatcheries, and they want to know, do the fish go back to the river from the hatchery that they came from? And for down here, the only creek that's even marginally swimmable for a salmon is the Pescadero Creek, Butno Resource Conservation District. They did an amazing dredge job down there, and it took a decade. Apparently dredging takes a decade, so you have to be really patient. And our dredge project in the harbor has started. You just can't see it yet. It's behind the scenes. But down in Pescadero and Butno, RCD has cleared out a lot of the creek now, and they are getting salmon up there. They actually call them steelhead, which is another form of salmon. I had to look it up because I didn't know the difference. So there's a little bit of movement, but from what I can tell from the fishermen that I was talking to, as I said, are these the fish that you're going to fish in 2 or 3 years? And they were like, yeah. And and I myself in the outer harbor, as somebody, you know, as a yacht club member, and I paddle a lot, you know, you see salmon in the mouths of the sea lions all of the time. And it's the first time I ever saw a sea lion eating a salmon. Actually, it was a family of sea lions. And actually, these ones were harbor seals. And I was seeing something orange kind of flitting back and forth, you know, maybe about 50 feet from the shore by the yacht club. And I thought it was a buoy that was just, you know, something was tugging on it. And then I saw the seal, you know, messing around with it. I thought, well, maybe he's playing with the buoy. And then I see two flashes of salmon, and there's another harbor seal there, and they're eating a salmon. And the last little bite was the tail, and it was the baby salmon. It was a family of harbor seals, and the baby just ate the end of the salmon, and the tail went down its mouth, and it just closed like a fan. And then it was gone. And I was standing with somebody, and we just looked at each other like, that was so cool. So, and I know that the commodore of the yacht club one evening comes into the club, and it's like 5 o'clock. I have a beer in front of me, and I said, Howard, what are you doing? You know, he had a fishing pole in his hand and boots on. He said, oh, I'm going to go get a salmon out at the right at the entrance. And I go, oh, really? And this is maybe before I saw the salmon being eaten. I was like, I didn't even know that there was salmon in the harbor or nearby. And he goes out. In the whaler, goes to the entrance of the thing, drops his pole in there. First time he gets a salmon, and he's back before I finished my beer.
Oh, wow.
So there's a lot of salmon out there, but you can't catch them now because the season's over.
Yeah, and do you know off the top of your head how long a salmon season would typically be? Like, how different is a 2-day
season? Oh, no, it was months.
That's insane.
Yeah, and I mean, we used to have hundreds and hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of salmon.
Yeah.
And I know somebody could call in and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the Bay Delta plan demanded, as part of the plan, to have hatcheries. That was their way of ameliorating the fact that they were making the rivers much more difficult for the salmon to get up to. But the good news is the Klamath had 4 dams, and all 4 dams have been taken down. And that also took decades. But that is on the California-Oregon border. So a lot of our fishermen actually have gone north.
Mm.
The commercial fishermen, they've gone north to fish. And they did so as well in crabbing season. So it's going to be hard for the harbor to survive without having a consistent crabbing season. There's actually There's another podcast on the coast. It's called Between Shifts. And there's these three guys. They're in their late 20s, and they grew up here, and they're interviewing all kinds of cool people. And I just listened to Tom McGurk, Cowboy Fishing's podcast last week. And he talks about how, you know, when he first started, you know, you'd have Thanksgiving crab weekend. And, you know, most of the fishermen would make their money, you know, for most of the season, both at Thanksgiving, at Christmas. And now I think we had a season that was maybe in a month in February or March. It was very short. It was like just 4 weeks. And that's just not enough for a commercial fisherman. And so the harbor's trying to figure out what to do. And I think that one of the things that they're doing is they're developing an ocean science center idea, just to make people come down here for more educational purposes. I mean, there's a lot of places that do that, and they've been going to a lot of the different places to see what they do and see if it's something that we could do here. So that
and I know there's at least in regards to the crabbing season, I know there's a lot of technologies and things being kind of worked on and invented to make crab
pop up crab traps.
Yeah.
Oh, which
I want to acknowledge my dad on that, because yeah. I'm sure many people had the idea at the same time, but the first time that we had heard about the crab season being so cut short, I remember that was the first thing out of his mouth. Wouldn't it be cool if they could make crab pots where the rope was coiled, it was coiled like just on top of the pot with a buoy that you could then, when you're ready to grab it, just pop it. The buoy comes up and then you grab it, and then the line isn't just hanging out there the whole time. And yeah, so he put that idea out there as just an offhanded comment. And then as over the last couple of years, starting to hear people work on things like
yeah.
that was just really cool, because my dad's very smart and I look forward to
that. Is so funny, because I have not had this conversation. We talk a lot, but I've never had that conversation with you. So I did the same thing when I have invented things, and if there's a problem, it's just an invention solution waiting to happen. And I had the same idea, and I called it, there's an app for that. And I was actually the owner at Mike at the Seville restaurant down in the harbor. I was having lunch there, and he sat with me, and we were just talking, and I said, yeah, and he's a techie dude. And I just throw this idea where, yeah, you have the ball, and it's attached to string rather than rope, because it's got to be light enough for it to float up to the surface. And then there's a geolocating app that would just signal down there. And Mike was questioning whether the RF signals would be strong enough in that. And I was like, that's beyond my pay grade. I just got the ball floating up there. And then once the ball gets up to the winch and everything, then there's a rope that is attached to it. And they just, you know, reel in the crab traps, because they're all sort of lined up in the same way.
Yeah.
And then I was talking to a fisherman about it. And I said, I'm really excited about this technology, because the company that they're using right now, I believe, is from Australia. When I had my idea, I talked about it a lot. And I was like, how can we be, you know, in Silicon Valley, just on the other side of the hill from Silicon Valley, and how can we not have solved this problem? And I know that there are four boats in the harbor that are trying it, and it's being funded so that, you know, it's sort of a larger experiment. I'm not getting really great reviews on it, and I'm not sure if it's just because it's so different and because it's using technology. But one of the fishermen did say that the fishermen who are not using the app don't know that there are crab traps underneath the water, because there's no buoy.
So they might be putting their trap on
yes.
top of somebody else's trap.
Exactly.
Well, you know, all new technology requires, you know, lessons learned, and it's, you know, not failure. It's just learning a way to not do something.
But that's so funny that Brad, the dad, came up with the same
Yeah, and I'm just going to acknowledge, I'm sure 7,000 people had the same thought at the same time, but it was just...
Well, maybe. Yeah, yeah. So Brad, the dad, will be here in July.
Yes.
And I get to come on and get to confabulate with Brad, the dad, as well as Crystalline, so that'll be something to look forward to. I remember watching Hawaii 5-0 back in, like, the late 60s.
Oh, the original.
The original. And I remember they would throw these little nuggets of science in there, and they were talking about how people made it to Hawaii, and how different, you know, Polynesian islands were building boats. So people were coming up with the same solution to the same problem even back then. And ever since that time, and I was probably 10 at the time, I've held that in my mind, is that we are all free to come up with a solution.
Yes.
And an invention. Don't be waiting.
Yeah.
You
know? And fun fact, different people can come up with different solutions for the same things, and they can all be cool and right. There doesn't have to be just one.
Yeah, I agree. And I think in regards to, you know, the pop-up crab traps, I'm not sure how much competition there is, but this would be an opportunity for a local entrepreneur, you know, to see if there's another way to, you know, dangle the thing. So, but that's about, and the real, you know, because for those of you who don't know, the reason why the crab season is abrogated is because of the whales.
Yes, because they can
get entangled
with
the ropes
that connect
right.
The buoy on the top of the water to the crab trap at the bottom.
Right. And I think that's just another thing that makes it more difficult for our commercial fishermen, because they really have two seasons. I mean, back in the day, they actually had herring, they had squid, they had a lot of different other sort of fleets. They all require different rigging and stuff like that. And I think it'll be very interesting to see how the fishing fleet evolves at this point, because it's going to need something more than what they're doing right now.
On top of not only having to update their equipment and the ways that they're doing the fishing, but then also their boats, because then there's, on top of everything else, a lot of eco requirements about boats trying to get away from gas and getting more electric and all of these things with their motors and stuff. So fishermen are also facing challenges on that side of it, trying to keep up with all of the environmental regulations, even just as it pertains to equipment. So it's hard to be a fisherman in this day and age. So kudos to those who are out there making it happen and bringing us all that seafood that people love to eat. I personally am allergic to crab and shellfish, but it's really funny because my dad loves it and will make special trips out here. So I always know my dad is coming for crab because he'll want to meet me for like breakfast or an early lunch so that he can see me before he gets contaminated with the shellfish. And then he's got his big cooler and goes to the harbor. So.
Oh, that's nice.
Yes,
that's
really I appreciate him, his thoughtfulness in seeing me before he sees the crabs of death.
Well, Crystalline's told me what it's like when she gets the crab attack. My mom was actually allergic to crab, and to the best of my knowledge, I don't remember her ever getting any, you know, anaphylactic response or anything like that. But Crystalline's had it.
Oh, gosh, yes. Kind of a boring conversation for radio, but yes, my allergy is very, very sensitive and intense, and I can't even go into a restaurant where shellfish is any majority of the menu, because that little spray that when you like crack a crab and there's that little little spray that comes out, that's actually what I'm allergic to. So
when we eat out together, I have to be very careful about what I
eat.
I remember I was going to get some crab thing, and Crystal, her face was like, that's a radio face.
Oh, yeah. I don't like being the person that ruins the meal. Like, people love their crab. They love their lobster. They love their shrimp. They love their oysters. Like, all of these things. It's like when they go to a restaurant, usually that's like a treat, right? It's not the normal like potatoes and mash and whatever.
Yeah.
And so then to be the one be like, I'm so sorry, just because I'm sitting at your table, you can't order any of that.
We eat at Metzaluna most of the time, and there's always good stuff to eat. So.
Yes, absolutely. Right. Well, after your exciting salmon day, have you done anything else super fun this week?
I had
it's been meeting heavy, I know.
I had 30, you know, Crystal and I talk about the magical fifth week. That's the week that, you know, a lot of the agencies don't have meetings, because it's the fifth week. It's usually like they'll do first and second Tuesday, or, you know, third Wednesday, or whatever it is. So, I was coming off a week where, there's the first week can be pretty light as well. I was coming off 2 weeks where I only had like 4 meetings. This week I had 9 meetings.
Yeah.
37 hours of meetings.
That's many hours.
It's a lot. It's a lot. And sometimes the meetings I have to listen, like on Tuesday, I had to listen to the PMAC meeting that starts at 6. And then Coastal County Water District, PMAC is Pescadero Municipal Advisory Council. Oh, and they have a They have a vacancy right now. So
oh, right. That was the big news this week.
Yeah, Rob Skinner stepped down. So now there's a vacancy. So if anybody knows anybody in Pescadero, just pass the word. I know they're trying to put the word out down there. They've got a bulletin board and things like that. But they asked me to put it up on Buzz. Now I'm putting it up on KHMB.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it'll be on KPDO because Catherine Peary is the general manager down there. And so we try to do a full court press, you know, to make sure. And it's going to be, so they're still at large, but they only have five counselors. They used to have 11, but they were all sort of appointed. But this time they had an election.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was the first time they had an election in 20 years. And so there's five people on the council, and now they have one down, and they're going to need one more person. And it's not going to be appointed. What people can apply, mm-hmm. and then they will be nominated. It's kind of like Granada Community Service did it. Once they're nominated, then they show up at a PMAC meeting, and they talk to the PMAC and the public about who they are, and then the PMAC will decide which one of them they want.
MCC, I feel like, did that as well, right?
No, they were all appointed.
Oh,
and so that's the difference. So Ray, there were people. There was three people that put their name forward, but then Ray just appointed them.
Oh, got it.
So they had no election. I mean, it was fine. We've got.
But we should note they tried to have an election. They were slated to be. The MCC was slated to have people on the election if they had applied. They just hadn't. Nobody had applied to be in the election.
Yeah, and the MCC is a Mid-Coast Community Council. It's a difficult animal because they don't have any staff, and they're advisory.
Which I just find so not fair to them.
Oh, I think it's not fair. Yeah. And there's PMAC is the same thing. They get like $3,000 a year, and that's what the MCC gets. They get $3,000 a year, and that pays for like their Zoom, you know, license and, you know, just instant, you know, internet, the website, you know, keeping it up. And that was done 100% by Lisa Ketchum, who passed away on Easter. And Dave Olson, who's a former MCC council member, he's taking over the website to keep that up.
Oh, that's awesome. Thank you, Uncle Dave. And I mean that literally.
That's right. And so the PMAC website is very rudimentary, and they've got boxes and boxes of historical data that really needs to be digitized. So it'd be nice to see if somebody could be assigned to both, you know, I mean, and not just to show up at the meeting, because I know Kathy Moazad is Ray's aide for PMAC, and she's always there. And then Marisol is Ray's aide for Supervisor Mueller's aide for the MCC. But they just stay there for the beginning of the meeting, and they don't really necessarily stay the whole time. Sometimes Marisol will stay, you know, remotely online just so that she can comment on things.
But they're there to provide information and receive information on behalf of Ray.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not there as staff to help either MCC or PMAC, whereas this is where I get a little kind of frustrated with how the county handles those two elected bodies. Because first and foremost, they're elected bodies. They've gone through a process. They're, you know, volunteering their time to be on these elected bodies. It's an official body that represents different parts of our coastside. And the county will not give them a staff member to help them organize and run their meetings and make sure that their Zoom is working and make sure that there's somebody ensuring that they are keeping in line with their bylaws and they are following the rules of order. Like they get these.
And the Brown Act and things
Brown
like
Act
that.
And all these things. And just really just being there as their help and support. Whereas there are county commissions like the Ag Commission.
They're actually, I just looked it up. I thought they were a commission too, and just
committee.
They're committee, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, committee.
So they're advisory.
Advisory, but.
And appointed.
But they get the privilege of having county staff as a part of their meeting and helping them and making sure that their agendas are emailed out. And like
that's
that all
true.
Happens through staff.
Yeah, Olivia Boo is the San Mateo County person who's in charge of them. Yeah.
Yeah. So I just find it really, really disheartening that PMAC and MCC do not receive the same respect and privilege of having a county staff member assist them in the way that the other advisory councils or committees get supported.
I agree with you 100%. And I think I've been, just for my part, trying to understand, you know, the difference. And I think Ray did make a a rather large effort regarding PMAC, you know, getting them to be elected and legitimizing them more than they were before. And I'd like to think that Ray is going to look at both of these advisory committees, hopefully within the next year, and figure out a long-term solution for them. There is one other entity in the county, and that's Fair Oaks near East Palo Alto, and they are managed completely differently.
Yeah, that's kind of the, that is one of the downsides of unincorporated areas.
Well, they're unincorporated.
That's what I mean, yeah. North Fair Oaks, it's like, they're all just kind of, even in 2025, they are kind of the wild, wild west.
Yes.
Because they're unincorporated, so they just don't have many of the rules and regulations that the cities have, but then they all butt up against cities.
Yep.
So then people get confused about where boundaries are and does this apply to us and does this apply to them? And it's when you start, you know, understanding where boundaries are and this and that, it's very interesting how conceptually they unincorporated areas are still wild, which many people love. I don't know a single person in Montera or El Granada or Moss Beach or Pescadero that would opt to live in the city limits if given the choice.
Culturally, people who are mid-coast, they really don't like Half Moon Bay.
Well, they enjoy their
freedom. And this goes back to, like,
freedom from it.
Was it 1959 when they were incorporated, or was it 49? It was one of those
somewhere
nines.
Around 60 years ago,
and
if I recall.
Yeah, and basically,
oh my gosh, we found a stat I don't know, and I am embarrassed. I am sorry. I don't know when Half Moon Bay was incorporated.
We'll Google that when we're coming up our break in just a second. Half Moon Bay decided to incorporate just up to the Frenchman's Creek border, and they take the cherry stem where Sam is. And the beach house in that area there. So they get the tax break on that. I think the reason why they did it is because there was no infrastructure mid-coast. I mean, there weren't any roads. There was no water. There was no sewer. People are on wells. They're using septic tanks and stuff like that. And, I sort of understand that, but it's led to a lot of bad feeling because they get all the attention. They get all the money. And then mid-coast, to our point, has got the MCC.
And they have to live by the county's rules, which in some respects may be more strict than a city's rules because it's for a larger area and has to encompass more people and this and that. And then some rules are much more lax because the county's not going to be overly restrictive on something, knowing that 20 cities are just going to turn around and make their own.
Right. Well, the first thing that Ray said at the first MCC meeting that he attended when he was hearing all the things that the MCC wanted to do was he said, well, you know, you could incorporate. And with that, I think we're going to be hitting our ad just about right now, Frank. Is that right?
Yeah. And after this break, we'll come back.
And we'll talk about incorporation from the mid-coast. Let's drop that bomb.
This is Community Radio for the Coast Side. 100.9 Coastal Windage is brought to you by Cameron's Restaurant and Pub in Half Moon Bay. Come for the food, stay for the fun. That's Cameron's Restaurant and Pub on Highway 1 in Half Moon Bay.
This is Jay Michaels. Make sure to join me and Stan Warren Littrell coming up at 10 o'clock right after Coastal Windage. We'll have a look at today in history, plus we'll get to a brand new forgotten find. It all happens at 10 a.m. right here from 100.9 FM KHMB.
Okay, we have learned the art of Google. The city of Half Moon Bay was incorporated on July 15th, 1915. 1859. So that's really cool. And we are coming up on the birthday. So happy almost birthday, Half Moon Bay.
Excellent. And so Incorporated Midcoast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's it's one of those things where, well, you wouldn't want any community to lose the charm of that, did I say committee? Community. My coffee is not kicked in, clearly. But you don't want any community to lose the charm that made that community what it is, right? They've all got their own little personalities, you know. But when you start diving into the infrastructure pieces, like where does your water come from and where does your poop go and all of those different things,
yeah.
Having an area so separated by having like one agency services this area, one agency services this area, and some of that area being unincorporated and a little bit wild, it does pose a lot of heartaches that you want to logically feel like, oh, if we could just, even if you kept city and unincorporated separated, that there's just certain agencies that it would be nice if there was a nice way to do it, combining them, like the water services and the sewer services, so that it wasn't multi-agencies.
It's all a third rail conversation because the sewer authority is a JPA, has three general managers.
And what's a JPA?
Joint Powers Authority. So Granada Community Service District and Montero Water Sanitary District, they're called special districts. And SAM is not a special district. They're a joint powers authority with MWSD, GCSD, and Half Moon Bay. And then when you go to see a sewer authority Mid-Coast Side meeting, SAM meeting, you'll notice that when they vote, it all seems there's six people there. Yeah, well, Half Moon Bay gets two votes for each person that votes. So that's why Half Moon Bay's votes always are weighted differently, and that's part of the JPA.
Hmm.
And the reason why the sewer is down in Half Moon Bay is because in the 70s, there was...
Wait, just to clarify, the sewer plant?
Yes.
Okay.
The sewer plant is down right by the Kehoe neighborhood.
Got it.
it's right across this, the creek from the Pilarcitos Bridge as well. And so they decided to put it down because the design for sewer has always been gravity fed, and Half Moon Bay was at the bottom of the hill.
Are you saying poop runs downhill?
Poop runs downhill.
Oh, good. Good to know.
And that Montero, if you go to the Montero Water and Sewer District Office, there's a perfectly good sewer system right there. They had, the clarifier and everything. And when the Coastal Commission and the sanctuaries, the Farallon Sanctuary and the Fitzgerald Marine Preserve, all in the same decade, they basically were told that so I don't know if people know this, but there's a pipe called the outfall that comes from the plant. It's secondarily treated, and it goes out about a quarter of a mile or so. And it goes through, there's these little nozzles that are on the pipe. And they go for, maybe 40 feet or so. And they let the water out there,
Okay.
So, but they took that right away from Montero Water. So Montero, Granada, and Half Moon Bay had to build a pipe on land that goes 10 miles from Montero all the way to the sand plant. It's called the IPS, the Intertie Pipe System. And
And just to clarify, that was put upon them by the Coastal Commission.
Yes.
So Montero and Granada were totally fine to work on their own.
GCSD had their own sewer plant as well.
That's so right. They all were independent. And then the Coastal Commission came in and said, I'm just kidding, you guys now all have to forcibly play together.
Yep. Because the outfall had to come out from Half Moon Bay because that's not in the sanctuary border.
Okay.
Yeah, or Fitzgerald. I mean, it was a multiple layering for Montero Water Sanitary District that they, were allowed to do their thing. And then the environmental, complexity of a pipe, which is now 50 years old, and there's like the force main at Montero. So force main means it's a sewer pipe and it's under pressure. I said most of it's gravity, but there are some places where you have to pop it up over a hill. And so that's a force main, and that's, I think it's about a mile long. It's really pretty long. And, when a pipe gets old, it will leak. And in this particular case, it leaked, not from where you would have thought at the bottom. It leaked from the top, and it was sulfuric acid that's created.
Ew.
And so it gets into chemistry and stuff like that, and it just basically corroded the pipe, and so that's what they're replacing it with. And old sewer pipe used to be made out of clay. Some of it was iron. In our case, what we do is we replace it with something called HDPE, which is a it's kind of a plastic pipe. It's much more resilient. The one of the things that happens with clay pipe is when there's a drought or there's a fluctuation in moisture within the pipe, the roots all go seek the moisture, you know, and so that's why you get roots in the pipes, and it's much more expensive to replace. And the HDPE is supposed to last for, you know, 50 or 60 years.
Which, just a little pause, if anybody's into like those kind of like YouTube videos that are oddly satisfying, these days, at least for houses and stuff, people are getting their, to try to save their pipes, they get them lined now with that blue kind of plastic.
Yes.
And anyways, watching the videos of that blue plastic being pulled through and then put into these pipes is actually like very cool.
It is very cool. In fact, I shared a CCWD video. It's called it's a lining. It's a
there you go. Yes.
And what they do is a lot
with your proper terms. Love it.
It is such a cool thing. It's a great technology, so they don't have to redo the pipe. Yeah. They can literally send that lining through a pipe that's got cracks in it, and they're good to go. And they did it underneath Highway 1, right by Miramar.
Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah, and I didn't either. Nobody gave me a press release on it. But anyway, I was bicycling along, as I want to do, and all of a sudden I see this whole team out there with their pipe lining, and I'm like, I got my camera out there, I'm taking pictures, and then one of the guys says, yeah, we're making a YouTube video, and I was like, yes!
Oh, that's awesome. Okay, I feel like people might think that was a very clever setup on my part for that story, but I also am just learning this just now.
Well, I guess if we've dug this deep into poop, I might as well go all the way with the lawsuit.
Oh, yeah.
So there's a lawsuit. The city of Half Moon Bay is suing GCSD and Montara Water because they don't think they're responsible for the IPS. And
is that related to the leak that you mentioned? Did that kick that off?
It's called an SSO amongst the sewer savvy, and that's sewage spill. And you get fined for it.
How do I get that merit badge? I want sewer savvy on my Carhartt vest.
And you get fined for that. There's State Water Resource Board. They anything that's liquid, they're in charge of, and they fine you for it. Mr. Burrell is our man that we have to check in with all of the time. And that's part of the function of how sewer systems are funded. The United States federal government funded all sewer systems in the United States in the 70s. There was the Water Pollution Act, and then in 1972, and then by 75, 76, they called it the Clean Water Act. Like, we've done our job. We've given you the money. We're good to go. We're going home. Good luck with that. And so our funding for sewers is various. And the county has 10 sewer systems that they actually manage themselves.
Can I just say that, just in general, like this whole thing that of people, like governments or whoever, funding something to start it up without willing to be a part of how to figure out to make it sustainable is still a thing that happens today.
It's terrible.
It's mind-boggling because it's like, yeah, okay, great, thank you. Give us $2.5 million to get something started, and while we're so busy trying to get the thing done and built and off the ground, the 2 years are up, and then now we're all having to fledgle and figure out how to build these relationships to keep this thing going, because why in the world would we spend this money on something we can't maintain? It just happens time and time again. Sorry, and we can go back to that conversation, but
it's just really
a weird system that's developed.
The business model sucks.
It does.
And I think, a lot, you know, when people ask me questions about stuff, you know, all the the first thing I have to do is explain the business model. And so all of that 1970 money, that's grant funding. That's how pretty much anything we were talking earlier about, Johnston Pier. And, you know, why doesn't the Harbor District spend more money on Johnston Pier? Well, it's because they're going for a PIPD federal grant. I don't know how that's going to go, but that's the idea. Is you have it's like a $40 million grant they need, or $30 million. I mean, it's a massive amount of money, and the Harbor District is funded generally by a little bit of property tax countywide, so it's just not enough. Mm-hmm. And I think with the sewer authorities, it's the same thing. Once the federal government went out of there, and you get all of these, you know, unfunded mandates from the state of California, because, you know, you don't want poop everywhere. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's bad. It's not as bad as radioactive material that was deposited by the Navy, you know, somewhere between here and the Farallons, you know, in a deep valley. But they look towards that sort of thing. And so, and this is exactly what Half Moon Bay is arguing, is that IPS is not our problem. Our plant is here. We're good to go. And I think there is a discussion, I know it's a discussion I often have with people, is one of the ways to fund things, like for City of Half Moon Bay, they could have a sewer assessment district. Now, whether that's a whole, you know, JPA, Joint Powers Authority assessment district or not, that's another way to fund things. Because the other big thing that we're going to have to fund pretty soon is PFAS control and elimination.
I don't know what that is.
PFAS is the forever chemicals. It's the... Nancy's a little kitty that Frank has, and I think she's talking to us. So that's going to be another unfunded mandate. I know the Biden administration.
And we should clarify, an unfunded mandate is?
They tell you to do something by law, and they don't give you money to do it.
Yes.
And that's the biggest problem, that I think almost every public agency that I cover, whether it's water, whether it's the city, whether it's the county, you know, getting funding from the federal government or from the state isn't a gimme.
Oh, yeah.
And then for here, because we have a lot of large houses, and I know that the people in the houses are often on pensions and things like that, which is, it's the criteria for grants. Mm-hmm. And actually, my last job that I had was with a water engineer, and I was starting the grant writing process. I quit. Couldn't stand it. It was the interface for applying for the grant was the internet interface, the computer interface was terrible. It kept crashing. The website kept crashing, and then you couldn't get a hold of anybody, so you'd have to do your work 2 and 3 times. And I know during COVID, there was this lady who came up with a saliva test for COVID. She couldn't get any grants for it until the MBA basically said, we'll pay you to perfect that. And that's how they had a squizzle and spit COVID test, because they didn't want anything up their nose.
Oh.
Notice that the rest of us didn't get that.
Yeah.
So, but again, she couldn't get grant funding, and this was like on a podcast, and she said, and the guy says, well, because it was an economic podcast, you know, how much time do you spend on grant funding? And she said 24%.
Oh, yeah. I know
such
many.
Such a waste of time of staff.
I know a lot of city time, a lot of other, like, nonprofits. Because also a part of the grant process is then the reporting for the grants that you
yes.
get. So you could
yes.
almost end up needing a part-time staff person just to collect the data and
yep.
generate the reports that then prove that you're using the grant funding correctly. Now,
yep.
you obviously, whoever's given the grant wants to know that the grant funding is being used properly, right? Nobody wants to find out that those monies are being siphoned off in an improper way. But sometimes, many times, and especially from my understanding, I personally have not tried to get any federal grants of any kind, because the chamber is a 501c6. So we are not eligible to get many of those grants just based on our nonprofit type. And so, but I've heard from others that work at 501c3s mm-hmm. that at this day, some of the things that they actually do have to take into consideration when we're taking on a grant is how much reporting the agency mm-hmm. is requiring, because it actually might negate the actual effectiveness of the grant if they are then losing a staff person.
Yeah.
To just work on the reporting.
Yeah.
Anyways, grants are just a hairy
it's
business.
Like the dredge project in the harbor. They have a 5-year mitigation requirement for 5 years, they've got to see what happens to the sand on Surfers Beach for 5 years.
And I'm sure there's very specific data and metrics that they have to collect. So that's not just every year we put eyeballs on the beach and say, hey, there's sand still there.
They're actually going to put a surf line camera on top of the new bathroom at Surfers Beach. That was one of the harbor commissioners' name is George Dormerat, and he actually used to work for the Army Corps. I mean, you know, between General Manager Pruitt and George, I mean, they walk into Washington, D.C., and they know everybody. Aww. You know, I mean, it gives us a little more chance to maybe get the PIPD funding. And no, I don't remember what PIPD stands for. I'm just like I even remember the acronym at this point. But for the dredge project, this is an example of how public agencies and CEQA, the California Environmental Quality Act, which is also in the 1970s, sort of monitors everything that you're supposed to do in terms of like keeping the environment, you know, looking good.
Cool and healthy.
Cool and healthy.
I also want to acknowledge that we will go back to the sewer.
Okay.
Lawsuit. We have totally taken an ADHD tangent, but we will get back to it.
We're actually just talking to ourselves. We just happen to be listening. I'm just kidding. She does this professionally every Friday. I'm just like interloping in here.
To be fair, this is how most of our conversations go, and they last 2 solid hours.
And Ruben said in the email for the guest host that you might want to have 90 minutes of material, and I'm like, I got 90 hours. I'll fit you in. But just briefly on the dredge, because that's going to be happening. You're going to see a lot of motion and movement in the harbor. They are going to be taking sand from the eastern arm where they say there's some eelgrass there. And this was a 10-year permit. And in year 7, after 7 years, The Marine Fishery Department, I'm not getting the actual thing perfectly clear, but they decided that we needed to replace the eelgrass where we were dredging. And then we have to put the eelgrass near the Mavericks Beach, so on the west, by the little nook by the west arm, sort of near where Caleb, the tugboat, is. It's going to cost us $1.2 $1.2 million for a permit requirement. We're 7 years in to getting, I think it was like 16 entities. And that's just an unfunded mandate. And it turns out that eelgrass it's a new requirement because it's sort of new-ish science. And there was a tsunami, you know, the Tongan tsunami. That was the cheapest dredge that the harbor has ever had. It just took out so much of the sand from the harbor. It created like a half mile whorl of sand that came out of the harbor mouth. And so it would take eelgrass as well. And then I listen to all the Coastal Commission meetings, and I do that because there's a pattern. And there was a Morro Bay permit for oyster beds, and they had a 20-year eelgrass survey done aerially. The eelgrass does not stay in the same place. So what they're trying to do by moving it, you know, into one place, and the sand has covered up most of the eelgrass on the east part of the arm, and because there's more sand there, there's more people there, you know, getting their clams and stuff like that. So now you got people trampling on the eelgrass. So there's numbers along the rocks, because I paddle, I can see them from the outer harbor, and there's a number 31. That's the last place where I could see the sand was exposed. You know, no eelgrass. So there isn't that much eelgrass at this point. And then somebody, the fish guy, he said that he saw some eelgrass that was sort of near the Romeo place, sort of at the end of West Point. And I'm like, well, it moves around all of the time. And then it's yacht club season, the youth sailing season. And as soon as youth sailing starts, the fog comes in, and we have a seaweed die-off. So the kids are walking around in, you know, a foot to 2 foot of seaweed and stuff like that. So I think when you see the cycle of what the eelgrass is doing, it's really, really complicated. But to add another $1.2 million, which means we had to get a grant funding for that, and then there's going to be mitigation for that, it just makes that all the more complicated.
Yeah.
So,
oh, the joys. The joys.
I'm working up a sweat now.
Government is hard on its own, let alone how much intergovernment and agencies have to work together to even just get the smallest things accomplished. And whenever you have agencies going in on something together, well, just like with any business or any partnership, right? People are going to have different thoughts and ideas and viewpoints and different things that they're in charge of, whether it's like
fish
or seagrass or sand,
right.
You know.
I know.
You know, at some point it's somebody's job to just sit there and try to figure out how to make all of that work.
Really exciting news. Very exciting news for me. As somebody who used to be in land use and just long enough to know a little bit about, well, I taught CEQA in the early 90s, and it was like, this is the CEQA industrial complex. Surely you don't make people do all of these things. Yeah, you do. But there's a guy, Brad Damitz. He's the consultant for the Dredge Project, and he's been on it for 10 years. And he gets all of these people in the room. I was at the NOAA and all of the, you know, Resource Water Control Board. Everybody was there. And Caltrans. It was actually a Caltrans meeting about Surfers Beach and stuff like that. But he and a couple of other consultants have come up with a streamlining of this. And I got to see the document. Very sexy document. And when I get permission, I will
Hey Frank,
we got music all of a sudden. But as soon as I get the document, I will release it, because I know there's enough geeky buzz people that would read the document.
Yeah.
Because this is the type of solution that we're looking towards, and I think CEQA is coming under fire because it's become burdensome again. It's another majorly unfunded mandate. And so, yeah, and that's the biggest problem, getting back to the sewer plant and the lawsuit.
Uh-huh.
So the lawsuit is going to start on July 17th. It's gone from mediation to a lawsuit over the last 4.5 yeah. years. And each side has won once and lost once. And now we're going for the third. I believe it's going to be a judge trial. But they had another judge trial just a year and a half ago, and Half Moon Bay won that one. And it's so complicated because it's sewer. And a lot of people don't understand. Well, okay, so the lawsuit's about the JPA, the Joint Powers Contract. It's 11 pages, and on page 7 it sort of says, you know, the answer to the lawsuit.
Oh, okay, wait. So there's a contract between three authorities about how to run sewer systems.
The city and two special districts, but yes.
And it's only 11 pages.
Yes, it's very short.
That's insane to me.
It was written in the 1970s. They were much more brief back then.
Oh my gosh, I couldn't even imagine. If that was created today, that would be 1,002 pages.
Oh, I know. Yeah. But the thing is, they can still have lawsuits over 11 pages or 1,000 pages, you know?
Wow.
It just makes it more complicated. But,
yeah.
I, you know, with the judges, what happened during, because it's up on my website, and I'm going to be posting it again to remind people if they want to tune in for the lawsuit, because it's really cool. You can actually watch the it's kind of like, you know, a Judge Judy, but on steroids. They weren't talking about the JPA. They were talking about whether or not the IPS was used by Half Moon Bay. And so now you're getting into engineering, which is not exactly what the lawsuit is about, but from a common sense perspective, during storms, the upcoast is shut out of the sand plant because it can only handle what's coming from Half Moon Bay. And then we have, you know, that 7, 8 miles, 10 miles of IPS. That's pipe. It's a storage pipe. And then there's two large storage boxes underneath El Granada. Some people might have remembered the boxes being installed maybe 3 and 6 years ago, and there's 200,000 gallons each, and that is also, it's called wet weather storage. Getting back to the problems of how sewer engineering is done with clay, you get something called INI, and that's it's the inundation of the pipe from the water that is coming down from the rain. Rain looks for pipes. It runs along the outside of pipes. It's looking for a crack, and it will find wherever it can go, it will go. And in the last 22-23 storm, the sewer plant came within 3 inches of taking out the whole electrical plant.
Whoa, 3 inches.
And so, it was very close. Phew. It was very close. And so now we're talking about whether or not we're going to get FEMA money that was supposed to be allocated to actually fix that, situation. And it looks like we're going to get money for the design, but we may not have the money for construction, which doesn't really do it. And that's just it. You get a grant for one thing, and then you have to get a grant for another thing.
Yeah.
So, it'll be interesting to see if, there's still a month to go. It's still possible that people could settle out of court.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of hoping for that. But to tie the whole conversation together, between Half Moon Bay and the Midcoast, that is our connection, sewer. Mm-hmm. CCWD water goes up to El Granada in Princeton. And then from that point on, like the Pillar Ridge Mobile Home Park, manufactured home park, they're on Montero water. And then Moss Beach and Montero are on Montero water.
Mm.
And they get their water not from the Hetch Hetchy, but from a well called Alta Vista and a bunch of other sources, but that's their major well. And then everybody else gets their money from Crystal Springs, from Hetch Hetchy, which is up in the Sierras. And then it comes all the way down to us in mm-hmm. Half Moon Bay and El Granada. And that's a pretty stable, the CCW is a very stable system.
Mm.
They, great board, great staff. They've been doing it for a long time.
Shout out to Mary.
Yeah.
Shout out to Dave before Mary.
That's right. No, they got a great crew. Getting your water, where do you get your water from and where do you go poop? Those are things that a lot of coastsiders don't know, but they're two of the most expensive things that have to happen infrastructurally speaking. Right now they're doing a Carter tank, remodel because all the tanks were made out of first of all, they're just old, so they're made out of old technology, old metal. And now they're using metals, they're using like some sort of composite material where they have braided cable that's built within the wall of the tank.
Oh.
And I'm going to be sharing that one because they did a really good video of taking the old Carter tank down and putting the new one in. And again, this is another grant funding. Actually, the CCWD actually went for a bond just recently because they've got so much infrastructure that they have to update because they got a lot of the agencies get audited by one agency or another telling mm-hmm. you that, time has gone on. You need to have seismic, retrofit and stuff like that. So that's what they're doing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. This has been really informational and good and fun conversation. These are the conversations that Michelle and I have weekly. And it's really fun because we will text during when we both know that we're at the same meeting. We'll text and be like, oh my gosh, did you just catch that? Oh, what are they saying? Why are they doing that? What is happening? So it's really fun. So
I always thought it'd be
really
kind of fun to have a radio overlay where we're
our real-time comments.
You'd probably get into trouble.
Yeah, there would be a lot of FCC violations. It's very hard to keep it clean even for just this hour on a Friday morning, let alone during a government agency meeting of any type. But thank you very, very much for being here. And thank you for everything that you do on Coastside Buzz. I know a lot of people go to the website, coastsidebuzz.com. I know they follow you on the different social medias.
I'm on Facebook, Instagram, and now on Nextdoor.
Woohoo!
So Crystalline, she helped me with my website. Well, she didn't really help me. She rebuilt it. And she has this little plugin called Jetpack, and now it automatically goes to Nextdoor. And there's a lot of people on Nextdoor.
There are a lot of people on Nextdoor.
Thanks for that, Crystalline.
You're welcome. Well, that is it for us. Thank you so much for hanging out with us. And again, we hope Ruben is out there having the best time of his life and having time with the family. And thank you for joining us.
And we'll see Brad the dad in July.
Yes, yes. And that's it from Coastal Windage.
The talk of the coast.